I'd like to introduce my special guest this morning. His name is Ray West, and he maintains the website big-lies.org and nukelies.org. And today we will be discussing the very real possibility that nuclear weapons are in fact a hoax, and a variety of other subjects, I'm sure. So, Ray, welcome to the program. It's great to have you here today.
Hi. Hi, John. It's very nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay. Let me just introduce here. Now, most people haven't heard the idea that nuclear weapons don't exist. It's a complete surprise to them. And that was my position up to about 5 years ago. And at that time, quite a few people became interested in the idea, and I want to present some of the evidence we collected here.
Okay. Now, yeah, yep. Let's definitely do that. First off, how did you become interested in this subject? And I know you've talked about historical and scientific revisionism. So how did you get interested in these subjects?
Well, it's a long story. It started with the Vietnam War and extended through other topics. But the nuke thing was inspired by a video by Jesse War, which I've got on my website, and it grew from there, really. Now, my site at the moment is nukelies.org. I'll spell that if it's okay with you. I've known that people often get this wrong. It's nukelies.org. Mm-hmm. Now you'll be able to follow the discussion better if you go to that site, nukelies.org, and it's got the title World War II Japan, Proofs That Hiroshima and Nagasaki Were Not A-Bombed. And that's quite easy to find. Now, the discussion today is intended to be mostly about Hiroshima. Okay, I mean, there are related topics like H-bombs, the so-called Cold War, Cuba, nuclear power, the Second World War, and so on, the influence of paper money and Jewish power, and NASA, and so on. Now, I've got a 3.5-hour YouTube on that called Lords of the Nukes, which looks at all of them. But here, we're just trying to concentrate on one topic, Hiroshima, with the object of toppling the myth of the atom bomb.
Uh-huh.
Right? Is that okay?
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the videos that you have that I watched, and I'm going to have a link to this when I post this program, and of course I'll have links directly to both of your websites. The video is titled, Have you heard the idea nuclear bombs are a myth? And it's just a 7 or 8 minute video where you're going around and you're just asking average people if they've heard of this idea. And pretty much all of them said that they have not heard of this idea. And some of the ones that you talked to, they said that they had direct experience working with nuclear technology and nuclear weapons. But when you asked them to elaborate on that, they really didn't have much to say. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Yeah, people couldn't really explain what experience they had with them. They couldn't really tell you anything specific.
That's right. I did a similar video of people talking about the Holocaust. Uh-huh. Just a sample public opinion. I didn't really expect very many people to know about these things or to have explored them. Let me just repeat again, nukelies.org. I'll wait a bit so that people can find it. There's a Nukelies banner, a great big red and blue thing, which we've used throughout the existence of Nukelies. And then there are links to videos. And then below that, there's a forum menu, and look for number 5. It's World War II Japan, Proofs That Hiroshima and Nagasaki Were Not A-Bombed. And it's got some sub-comments. Now, this is to do with the 6th and 9th of August, 1945, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So we may as well start by discussing what happened on the 6th of August, 1945. And in my view, we can now say confidently that Hiroshima was firebombed in pretty much the same way as 67 other Japanese towns had been firebombed before it. Now, Hiroshima was a small town, so was Nagasaki, and also near the edge of the country. I mean, it's in an estuary, so it could be got away with as presented as though they were just bombing it with one bomber. And what happened with this system of bombing was you get key targets which you bomb with high explosives, some of the things like the post office and so on, and then most of the town was bombed with incendiary bombs based on gasoline. And then a few days after Hiroshima, when all the bombers were reloaded, resupplied, then Nagasaki was bombed. And there were reconnaissance photos taken of Hiroshima after the bombing, very neatly labeled with estimates of damage, and you can see that it's not symmetrical. The, for example, a post office was bombed and so on. Now, each of these raids, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, was followed by an official recording plane, supposedly to take films, and with observers. For example, there was one called The Great Artiste, which followed Enola Gay, with someone called Harold Agnew, who I think was yet another Jew. And following the bombing of Nagasaki, there were two people, Leonard Cheshire, who was a British aerial person, and William Penny, who was a PhD in maths. They were in a vehicle called the Big Stink. Now, and they reported quite accurately, I think at least Leonard Cheshire did. But generally speaking, it's a controlled information event, and everything else about it is fantasy. The whole idea of nuclear weapons is fantasy. Hmm. And okay, now I'll try and explain why it was done and the reasons for pretending it is. There was a let me just introduce the propaganda announcements. The Truman was only president after Roosevelt's death. I do suspect actually that Roosevelt would not have approved this project. I think possibly that was what happened. It's hard to know. On the 6th of August, there was a BBC radio broadcast about saying that an atom bomb had been dropped. So it was officially announced that it was an atom bomb right from the start. However, on the 10th of August, that's after Nagasaki, atomic leaflets were dropped on Japanese cities, not before that. The Japanese had to be told they'd been atom bombed, and in fact, a lot of them disbelieved it. And I think there's a link there with the Vietnam War. I think Japanese troops in Vietnam told the Vietnamese Americans were lying about it. At any rate, anyway, later on, 1946, August the 31st, that's more than a year later, there's a famous New Yorker free issue with an article by John Hersey, H-E-R-S-E-Y, on Hiroshima, which actually was published in Britain by Penguin Books. So there was a long process of telling people that it was nuclear, and it had to be under so, anyway after
so this sorry. this article in the New Yorker, I'm looking at it right here on the forum, it was in 1946, so well after,
it's more than a year after, yeah,
the alleged bombing. Yeah, and so they're coming out saying, yeah, look guys, this was a nuclear weapon, trust right. us.
Yeah, it was a free issue.
So even you know, as it happened, there was even people not only in Japan but also in the West that were saying that they were questioning whether or not it really was a nuclear weapon, correct?
Yeah, one of my YouTubes has a little extract from an American newsreel saying that they doubted, they didn't really believe in the nuclear bomb. They thought maybe it was an excuse to give Japan a chance to surrender. But anyway, yeah, from the start there was doubt about it. After 1945, the whole system expanded, and you had films of nuclear tests. And of course, most people's beliefs were shaped after 1945, and all the issues were juggled in a strange way, which it set a pattern for lies. In fact, which still exists. For example, as regards radiation, there's still endless lies about radiation, and this appeared in nuclear films, military films, newsreels at cinemas. The TV was coming in then, but it wasn't very important then. But now you can get the stuff on DVDs, videos. And in fact, there's a section in the nuclearized.org at the beginning of which directs you to look at all these films and so on. Now, mm-hmm. Okay, now let's look at the supposed Hiroshima bomb. I'll refer here to the nuclearized.org forum on Japan, you know, the proofs that Hiroshima and Nagasaki were not A-bombed. There are various elements here. There's the business of building it and dropping the bomb. Then there's eyewitness statements, including people who arrived there later. You know, there's photographic evidence, and there's the specifically supposed nuclear evidence, like physical damage, mm-hmm. radiation. And now, there's building the bomb and dropping it. The person who contributed most to that is called First Class Skeptic, who at the time I hadn't contacted or met or anything. Well, I haven't met him now. I haven't spoken to him. And he did some very good research into, for example, Major Thomas Ferrabee, who was supposed to have used a Norden bomb site to target this bomb. And the descriptions, mostly by journalists, are incorrect. There's no trigger on this thing. You set it beforehand, and it's supposed to go off automatically in case the driver, you know, in case the pilot's, the chap's gone to sleep or something. Mm-hmm. There's First Class Skeptic did also good work on the actual design and size of the bomb and the manipulation of it. If you look on, there are various films online of places like Tinian Island, where the thing was supposed to have been taken from, you know, from flown from, with its Quonset huts. And to cut a long story short, he, First Class Skeptic, showed that the bits wouldn't actually fit together. The little aerial, you know, wouldn't fit into the thing because of size restrictions. And the places it was filmed were not where they were meant to be. There were also different versions of it. There seemed to be a lightweight one which could be pulled easily around. So the little boy, that was basically a film prop. And that's quite an interesting aspect.
Oh, I was going to say really quick, one of the things that I was looking at when I was kind of researching and trying to get a better understanding of this whole idea of you know, nuclear weapons being a hoax, is that, you know, there was a lot of skepticism that they could ever even build a nuclear bomb. It was never really for certain that they could do this. And even leading up to one of the very first tests prior to allegedly dropping the bombs over in Japan, they weren't sure that this would even work.
Yes, that's right. The first, if you look at pictures of what they called atomic piles, which were basically big stacks of uranium, I'm not sure of the formulation of it. They were huge. I mean, it's like a whole room full of the stuff. And Einstein, for example, is quoted as saying that he didn't think that such a thing could ever be flown, could ever go into an aeroplane. Mm-hmm. It's just too heavy. So, yeah, there's no question about the scientific oddity of it. And this is where Jewish stuff comes in. I'll get onto that later, maybe. Anyway, the next thing is eyewitnesses. There's quite a good book, which I found by chance, called Children of the A-Bomb, or Children of Hiroshima, edited by somebody called Arata Osada. Apologies to Japanese listeners for my pronunciation. I don't know how to pronounce Japanese. And there's also a piece on false testimonies. If you read carefully, and it's quite difficult because you get this horrific stuff mixed in, but it's consistent with firebombing and not consistent with nuclear explosions. There's lots about burning, mm-hmm. burning buildings, thirsty people heading for rivers, that kind of thing. And there's one case which struck me particularly because it had a measurement, was that the woman who was supposed to have lived 600 meters away from the epicenter heard noises and opened her door and saw all these burning buildings. I mean, it's just not consistent with atomic bombs. Now, anyway, they had to fix on a story, and it didn't really run very smoothly. But since they had full censorship, it kind of didn't matter. I think the poor old Japanese had to. They were threatened, really. If you remember, there were only marginal war crimes trials for the Japanese. And I think one of the reasons was that they had to go along with all this other stuff. You know, if they were not, they could have been hanged or whatever, but they were, so long as they went along with this stuff, they were okay. Let me quote also from this, a chap called Crawford Sams, a medical doctor, as far as I know, in 1946. There was an atomic bomb casualty commission to investigate, and he was specifically instructed to inflate deaths by the supposed atom bomb. What he said was, the letter of instruction told him to play up the devastating effects of the atomic bomb. So anybody who'd been in Hiroshima and died within 6 months, whether they got run over by a bicycle or whatnot, would be credited with the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And his figures here are 250,000 people in it. They weren't anticipating, or they may have anticipated being bombed. By the way, there was a thing called the Doolittle Raid. Don't you remember that? It was in response to Pearl Harbor. Of course, they knew Pearl Harbor was going to happen. And to kind of seal things, they went on this raid in somewhere in Japan just to kind of ensure that there was a war going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
now, it's very well known that the city of Tokyo was firebombed. So yeah. are you basically just saying that they did the same thing in
yeah.
both Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and they just, you know, attributed
yeah, right.
it to this, you know, new weapon, this new super weapon?
Yep, absolutely right. They're small towns near the edge of Japan, so you can get away with saying that there was just one one aeroplane, which may have turned up later, you know, a couple of them turned up later. Uh-huh. I think part of the mythology is that there was just one plane high up in the sky and nobody paid any attention to it. But if you've got a small town near the water, you can get to it and firebomb it pretty quickly.
I was going to ask you about the radiation, because you have a couple links here. Radiation ? And there's actually a study that there was no genetic damage.
Yeah, that's right. They don't seem to have got their story very, very straight. You see, they wanted, for some purposes, they wanted to boost radiation, say there's an awful lot, because mm-hmm. then that makes people, for example, one of the functions of this was to keep the USSR under Stalin, which of course was Jewish run. They wanted to keep the USSR not invaded, because, you know, people might think, well, the USSR is not democratic, let's invade it. But if they've got nuclear weapons, that makes it more difficult. And if they're highly radioactive, it also means that the danger spreads to local countries. So that's, you know, it's boosted. Just in the same way that here's the thing here, this was what Sam said as well. The publicity was that a bomb went off and a city disappeared, you know, that Chicago just disappears just like that. But no such thing happened. Now, he attributes this to Life magazine and so on. In 1945 and 1946, they were told, you know, you could end the war with one B-17. And in fact, he worked out then that there were 21,000 people died in 36 hours as a result of being trapped and burnt. That was Sam's in 1946 or after it. And I've got a few little quotes here. So we see. Oh, William L. Lawrence, was a Jew who was given some sole rights to write about this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
September the 9th, he wrote a piece called Atomic Bombing of Nagasaki, told by a flight member. That was in New York Times. And 3 days later, he wrote one on blast, not radiation, taking the toll. That's also in the New York Times. Then on September the 13th, radioactivity at Hiroshima discounted. William L. wasn't his real name. And there's another Lawrence with a W. Which is to make things confusing. Anyway, they had some trouble getting their story straight. Mm-hmm. There's other evidence, which is evidence from the ground, photographic evidence. There's no evidence at all. There's no photos I've been able to find about showing a mushroom cloud over Hiroshima, despite the fact that the Japanese were quite technically competent. It's not a single one. There are two kind of showing something like a bonfire, but there's a very great lack of any photographic evidence at all.
So it was very important for the military, for the American military, to control the situation and control, you know, how this event was viewed, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I don't know if it's – you have to distinguish between the American military and the Jews, who essentially seem to have controlled it.
Well, same right.
Same with Britain, probably France as well. I mean, you talk about the French Empire or something. You don't know whether that's essentially a Jewish one. But that's the idea, yes. They control the evidence.
Well, let me read. You had mentioned William Lawrence, the guy for the New York Times.
Yeah.
Let me just read a little section here. This is on, let's see, radiation or no radiation, which was the misinformation? And this is a post. And mm-hmm. this is something that First Class Skeptic posted back in 2011. And it was it looks like it was a paper presented at the Think Outside the Bomb National Youth Conference on Nuclear Issues in Washington, D.C. And he says here, controlling the situation, and he's talking about, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, controlling the situation was exactly what General Groves did. A few months earlier, he had hired the New York Times science reporter, William Lawrence, to become the bomb's publicist in waiting. Groves' investment paid off handsomely. Lawrence crafted press releases and stories about the exciting dawn of a new scientific age, about the heroic effort to produce and use the bomb, and about the positive aspects of atomic energy. Lawrence, perhaps the first fully embedded journalist in history, helped shape how we Americans came to think about nuclear weapons and energy. He and other members of the media helped put in place a narrative that legitimized the use of nuclear weapons and absorbed the bomb into American life. They did this by accepting government control of information about atomic power, downplaying the dangers of radiation, and marginalizing the civilian victims, obscuring the fact that President Truman could have avoided the bomb and forcing Japan's surrender. So basically, so and what you guys are saying is that a lot of this radiation wasn't even well-founded. It was essentially just more propaganda.
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, our view is that there was no radiation at all. It wasn't an atomic bomb. I mean, whoever wrote that thought, believed in atomic bombs. It's quite common,
right.
There was, I don't know if you know, Dave Seversky. He wrote Victory Through Air Power. There was a first edition was in 1942, and it was made into a film showing, you know, aeroplanes bombing supply lines. But the 1950 edition, the next edition, 1950, commented on nuclear material, and it showed pictures of flimsy buildings with heavy roof tiles and so on in Hiroshima. So although Dzerzhinsky seemed to believe in nukes, he didn't think they had. He said their effects were indistinguishable from ordinary bombing. So it's a matter of same with Groves. Actually, I can't tell whether Groves actually believed in this stuff or not. I get the impression that Groves was a fairly simple kind of military chap, and he signed the checks. You know, he got $600 a year, whatever people got paid during the war, and he would sign all these checks for, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars for the so-called research stuff. I think he was a bit gullible. He spoke to David Irving. David Irving kind of quizzed him on the order to drop nukes, and he got some clues there. But Irving and Groves probably didn't know that the instruction was not for nuclear stuff. It was to train this operation of firebombing and then pretending it was nukes later. Anyway, there's another issue with photographic evidence. There's fake ones. You can see some of them have shadows in the wrong direction, that kind of stuff, and, you know, the ruins are impossible. Let me just go here. Let me just point out the reasons here why Hiroshima was not nuked and was firebombed. You've got various hard structures standing, like brick chimneys, the Bank of Japan building with its flat roof intact. All the bridges were still intact. There was no electromagnetic pulse damage, which they occasionally inflate into, you know, with phones, that kind of thing. And no crater. There should have been some sort of crater, presumably, because there was supposed to be a huge plume of smoke, and that must have had, you know, supposedly containing not just combustible stuff. So, whereas that is, in fact, that's compatible with a firestorm. There's a very good description by Leonard Cheshire of what sounds like a firestorm when he's describing Nagasaki, and the official writer was kind of going on about rainbows and things, he was padding it out. Leonard Cheshire described yellow smoke and things being carried aloft by the heat, that kind of thing, and a huge plume of smoke. Mm-hmm. So anyway, there's also other things as well. There should have been, what else should there have been? Let me see. Well, they're supposed to be loud. That's another thing, you know. This chapter quotes 248 decibels when eardrum rupture occurs at about 200. So there should have been a lot of deaf survivors and blind ones as well if there was a flash, you know. So people avoid these kind of issues. Anyway, during the 1940s and 50s, they inflated all these descriptions, and they made up, in my view, they made up H-bombs as to keep the process going. They wanted bigger and, you know, bigger and more expensive things. And expressions like deadly radiation and radioactively contaminated seawater are typical of descriptions for tests. And again, if you notice the tests there, they always tend to be underwater or hidden away or something. And it's very difficult to get any sensible atmosphere. Now, another thing here is the business about repairs. You know, they cleaned up pretty quickly, and streetcars were actually running 3 days after the bombing, which is not compatible with the thing being turned into a glassy area, is it? Let me just draw attention here. At the very top of that forum page, the one on World War II and proofs, there are two information items. One of them says, couldn't be a giant hoax, thousands of experts. I wrote that to answer the claim that large-scale cover-ups are impossible. In fact, there are lots of examples of them, including 9/11, for that matter. And the second of the two information items is the guided tour of the Hiroshima-Nagasaki Forum, and it outlines most of the links. For example, Einstein on patents, the first atomic piles, F.D. Roosevelt's foreknowledge of Pearl Harbor, the New York article, and antennae on the bomb, which weren't fitted correctly, and in any case wouldn't have worked, that sort of thing. So it's worth having a look at the guided tour because it gives a kind of overview in a scrambled up order. It also includes, let me see, I'll just read out a few more here, photo flash bombs as a possible way of pretending that there was a nuclear explosion. Claude Etherly is quite interesting as a fake who turned up later. The genetics and radiation, lack of link. Also, David Irving on Japan trying to surrender. I've got a YouTube of him saying this, actually, that Japan was desperate to surrender, but it was deliberately timed. They'd obviously arranged some schedule to, or schedule in the American expression, to arrange the whole thing. And I think one of the reasons was they had to have a test. The ship, the Annapolis, left San Francisco on the same morning that the Trinity test was took place. I think that was deliberate, that they had to pretend it was tested and to shoehorn in. They did that. Right. Does that make sense so far?
Yeah. And I'm going to have a link over to the guided tour so people can go check it out. And there's a lot to this. So I guess a question that I'd have, and I think most people would have, is if they really did just firebomb these cities, what was the purpose of introducing this idea that we do have nuclear bombs in our arsenal? Was this just another piece of propaganda to keep people in fear and to, you know, project power across the world? Is that essentially what it was?
There are lots of motives, and you have to distinguish between Jewish ones and ordinary people like Groves type ones, and I honestly couldn't tell you, but there are various motives for doing it. One of them was just simply keeping in work. You know, these so-called nuclear physicists actually were mostly, for example, Hungarian chemical engineers. You know, they were not special people. They just, the Manhattan Project was a big chemical engineering project, essentially, and they wanted to keep in work. At the end of the war, they might just get sacked, so they had the motive for keeping on with that, right? And of course, they could make money from that. You could have some research institutes, have nuclear research things all over the place, the kind of thing.
It created an entire new industry, basically.
Yeah, that's right. It's a bit like NASA, same sort of idea.
Okay, yeah.
They also had the political motive, as I was saying, to make sure the USSR wasn't invaded. They wanted to. They had, in my view, the atom spies, who were all Jews, as far as I know, the idea of them was to pretend that the USSR had nuclear weapons by pretending to have leaked secrets to them. You know, so you have all this stuff about, I suppose, photocopying. I don't know if they had photocopies quite then, but copying documents, shifting them to the USSR, and being traitors. And the point about that was that it would keep the USSR safe for Jews. Right. It also gave.
So they wouldn't be over. They wouldn't be invaded and overthrown after.
Well, the USSR was Jewish run, basically.
Right. Absolutely. By and large, anyways.
Yeah, and it also had, concentration camps and gulags, which made anybody else's look like, you know, child's play. They had, and there's all this stuff, all the evidence was still there. They wanted time to get rid of it. It also had another useful thing, that if you have nukes, it's a really dangerous thing. It gives you a good reason to bomb other countries. You know, you can say that this country's got nuclear weapons or facilities, and they've done that a lot. They did it with, Iran, for example, and Iraq. They both had facilities bombed by Israel, under what I would say is the pretense that they were developing nuclear stuff. So, you know, there are all these things. And the most important one probably is just the money. It was a huge industry. They expanded it into nuclear power, which in my view, I don't want to go into it here, it's also a fake, and things like nuclear submarines. So it was a great big industry. I mean, it was a very serious part. The entire post-1945 world has been distorted enormously by this Jewish thing, and of course it's fun.
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, could you talk about the history of the Manhattan Project, which, you know, we all learn about in school? This was the project which was launched to essentially develop a nuclear bomb, and if I'm not mistaken, it was said that, you know, these American scientists, many of whom were in fact Jewish, like Einstein and many others, they were saying that we needed to do this because the Germans were going to develop this technology before us. Is that correct?
Oh, yes, it was definitely anti-German.
Yeah.
Let me just say here, there's a part on the on nuclize.org. The eighth forum is entitled Science, Nuclear Physics, Astronomy, Space Travel, and it's got stuff about nuclear and atomic physics, theoretical physics, and missiles, bombs, and space science. And it's difficult because a lot of scientists, I've got listed Rutherford, JBS Haldane, Bohr, and Admiral Leahy, thought a chain reaction simply wouldn't work. And it's very difficult because, of course, all this stuff is classified. And even if you look in textbooks, which should discuss this issue, they don't. There's no discussions on things like the mean free path of neutrons, that kind of stuff, or the percentage that they'd have to go to split the nucleus and that kind of thing. There are other really disturbing kind of things as well, like, for example, uranium-238 has got three more neutrons than uranium-235, so on the face of it, it would be a much more worthwhile thing to try and split. And anyway, before that, before the Manhattan Project, this is in the 30s still, there was really bogus science by Jews. For example, there's a supposed experiment to prove fission, which involved, if you read the details carefully, this is another point that first-class skeptic got, because some of these scientific papers are online. If you're lucky, you can get details. And essentially, all they did was get a uranium compound, in water. I don't know what it was, uranium nitrate, I think it was, in water, and expose it to a source of neutrons, which is some pitiful little radioactive thing. And they left it for about 3 weeks. And at the end of that, they thought they detected barium in it. You know, the atoms are split. I think it's extremely unlikely that that would have been reproducible. And so it was built on a foundation of sand, really. And incidentally, more money was spent on radar than on the Manhattan Project by, I don't know, I've forgotten who it was. I think it was Chrysler. So it wasn't the only project. It's easy to kind of overestimate it. I think it got boosted in retrospect because of the supposed importance of it. I'll get back to that later. Let me discuss at the moment some of this other material here. I'll try and discuss why it is that atomic bombs are not credible, just even if you believe the full story. I've got several subheadings here. The flash is one of them, and the flash. You know, the point that it's very difficult to have a very brilliant flash. I think this is why most tests are done at night. Yeah, because we're done at night. Because even today you can't get a thing that's brighter than the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that something is brighter than 1,000 suns, is not possible. That's instead why they have feeble dark glasses. The dark glasses on some. I've got a YouTube of people putting these dark glasses on, and they're not really very dark at all. It's obviously for show. It wouldn't, if it was a really brilliant flash, it wouldn't work. Now, and the next is blasts. You're supposed to get blast damage, you know, but Hiroshima shows no sign of having a huge central blast. And they tried to boost this. They had in the 1950s films, they had black and white inserts of about a minute, which were carefully composed, showing models, and with the supposed reversing effect of dust going out from the explosion then going back as it kind of shrinks. And that's, they're entirely unconvincing. And there's also a problem with heat. You've got this enormous amount of heat supposedly generated, and you'd get, I don't think anybody tried to work out the likely results of having a really huge fireball. And anyway, that's that's another problem with them. Another problem is the heat. You've got a problem with enormous amounts of heat, and of course it's unmeasurable. It's too it's outside normal experience. And this is why, I mean, I think they invented a whole lot of things. For example, melting roof tiles, which is not true. Melting eyes was an odd thing, which of course wouldn't happen. Or if people have been evaporated away completely, or for that matter, towers, metal towers being evaporated completely, and desert sand being melted and turned to glass. So if you look at any of the evidence, there isn't any really. The shadow business in Hiroshima had, it was morning, 8:15 in the morning. It should have been crowded.
Mm-hmm.
But there's only found one or two so-called shadows. It's, they're desperate to find stuff there. And there's certain problems with condensation as well. If you've got huge temperatures, how could you possibly get condensed water and mist, so which is shown on some of these things, really to hide what's going on, you know, because there's a famous one, the Bikini one, has obviously got an explosion up the middle, and they've kind of painted onto it an expanding hemispherical effect. Okay, anyway, that's so those are all problems. Radiation is another problem. It's trouble is you can't see or feel it, which makes it ideal as a kind of subject for obfuscation, you know, and lies. The, by the way, the way the media controlled that was they had things like the Lucky Dragon, it's a fishing boat incident, mm-hmm. where the Japanese fishermen were supposed to be not followed some warning, and they allegedly had fallout dropping all over to them. Must have been planned. They had a hassle when they got back to Japan, but I think most of them are still alive, or you know, had standard life expectations. And now,
I've always been confused about radiation and X-rays, and you know how dangerous all this stuff really is. It's really never made a lot of sense to me.
I think it's probably deliberate. Well, X-rays are the same sort of thing as gamma rays, and they are unusual in being. Generate, you know, if you've got the equipment, you can make them indefinitely. You can just kind of switch them on and leave them going. Whereas particles being given off are a different kettle of fish, and they tend not to stress the difference there, although it is very important. There's also the fact that neutrons flying around are supposed to be part of the package, and they're almost undetectable. So not only have you got a problem with them being invisible, some of them are undetectable, and if you see pictures, if you see maps of supposed radiation distribution, for example, after Fukushima, it's a fake, really.
Isn't it a computer generated model, basically?
Yeah, you can generate computer generated stuff, but I don't know how much work goes into it. I wouldn't be surprised if it's just a sort of rough.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yes, radiation. There's another thing here about the mushroom cloud. Now, this was a mistake, actually. If you read the Lewis, people on Enola Gay, Genola Gay, I'm sorry, Gay, he was reported as saying that it was a stringer. They were overflying the ruins of Hiroshima and pretending to bomb it. I assume, and there was what he called a string. There were two things going up in the air, two columns, which they filmed from the right angle to make it look as though there's one. But there was no mushroom, you know. And somehow he drew a diagram of it on a menu, I think it was. But the mushroom cloud came in later. Somebody invented it. It's a bit like flying saucers, actually. Somebody invented this phrase casually. Some pilot says, "Oh, it looked a bit like a saucer," and the mushroom cloud was invented in the same kind of way. It was a casual thing, but they seem to have stuck with it because it's visually appealing. You know, it gives you something to look at. Whereas if you had a little flash lasting a billionth of a second, you're not going to get necessarily any identifiable thing like that.
Mm-hmm. Right. So this mushroom cloud idea is kind of just part of this nuclear bomb propaganda
to kind of scare people
and shock people.
Yep, and make it visually, you know, you can have cartoons with it in, that sort of thing.
Okay.
And, I mean, there's a film by, what's his name? It doesn't matter. The film with a fake atomic thing in the background, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are other things here. There's electromagnetic pulses, neutron bombs, but they're all dirty bombs, another thing, where they exploited the radiation ambiguity. They used to say dirty bombs would be very dangerous. Then they sort of switched around to saying that the amount of radiation they could spread is so tiny it wouldn't make any difference at all. There's nothing with suitcase bombs. You know, there's another propaganda thing. If you can, it's a bit inconsistent with the idea of having a critical mass, but you can scare people by claiming there are mini nukes and suitcase bombs. Yeah. Okay.
So you just see all of this propaganda about nuclear weapons as essentially just a Jewish concocted hoax, basically? Is that what this amounts to?
It is, but of course they get collaborators, don't they? That's the point. A lot of people go along with it. Let me try and explain the situation with the aid of Faurisson. In about 1935, the world map had what he described as four giants and three dwarfs. Right, you've got the giants are the US, sort of Western Hemisphere, and you've got the British Empire, which is a sort of water empire. You know, it's got Australia, Canada, India, and other things around the seacoast. And there's a French Empire, which included a lot of North Africa and Southeast Asia, including Vietnam. And there was the USSR. You've got these four great big things. And then you've got Italy, Japan, and Germany. And Germany is about the size of something like Texas, or maybe smaller in those days. I don't know. I mean, it's a small thing. But what's so that's quite a good visual image by Faurisson. But he did omit there's another thing, which is a Jewish axis going from Washington and London and Moscow, which is kind of superimposed. You can't show it on a map because maps have hard edges and things. But really, there is superimposed this kind of parasitic thing, which is controlling aspects of the policies of all these countries, of the U.S., Britain, and the USSR. So they were kind of superimposed onto the other stuff. So you have to try and separate the two things out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that makes sense to you.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's no doubt, and I think most people listening would totally agree with us that this secret Jewish cabal, well, it's really not even secret anymore, but they've always sort of operated behind the scenes and pulled the strings, out of the spotlight.
Yep, that's right. The visual propaganda side of things was taken care of at Lookout Mountain Studios, which was another one of First Class Skeptics' discoveries. If you look at the ninth forum on nuclize.org, it's called Nuclear Movies, Stills, Soundtracks. Check the media yourself for fakes and lies. That's my encouragement to people to look at these films, which are otherwise a bit unattractive, to see if you can find fakes in them. And the other thing, the printed propaganda, of course, was mostly Jewish. Jews had got control by paper money of most of the printed media, most important printed media, and they can print anything. Most of the reports came from military-controlled sources like the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission and the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey, and there's a joint commission for investigating the atomic bomb, that kind of thing. And there were a lot of the journalists themselves, of course, were more or less fake, like Wilfred Burchett as an example. It's quite a difficult person to pin down. He seemed to have been genuinely sympathetic to the Japanese, but the effect he had was to go along with the propaganda. And Japanese propaganda, Japanese control of information was still going. In 1995, there was a magazine called Marco Polo in Japan, which was closed down because they had a piece on Holocaust revisionism, just completely closed it. So, I mean, there's no question there's a lot of that Japanese information is controlled like that.
Mm-hmm.
What else we look at here? There's so much stuff to look at. Go on. Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say, I want to go back and talk a little bit more about the role that these journalists and photographers and, cameramen played in creating this propaganda that's been used to sell to the public, this idea of nuclear weapons and the threat of nuclear weapons and how dangerous they are. So what do you know about the people who actually captured or allegedly captured the video of what took place in Japan? I mean, is this, in your view, is this somehow manufactured and it's not a genuine capture of whatever bomb went off?
Okay. Well, in the first place, there are very few actual images, including of tests. You know, they make a lot of kerfuffle about filming these things and having special films, and, very fast cameras. But the truth is, there are very few things, and they're also staged. It's much easier to stage still pictures than just to stage movies. You appreciate that. And for example, there's one showing, I think it was supposedly taken at Bikini, showing an upright column of water with a very long, very horizontally very long sort of umbrella over it, and that's a fake. You can tell because they've got two different mock-ups, two different versions of the foreground, and all of these things are like that. They're all fakes, but the way they do it is quite interesting. I mean, some of them are done more subtly than others. There are some video ones which obviously show the sun. There's some in color, some in black and white. I've got one of my YouTubes shows a supposed British H-bomb test, and it's clearly just either a sunrise or sunset. You can tell by various obvious things. For example, when the supposed bomb goes off, there's no rippling in the water, and the sound is wrong. It comes too soon, that sort of thing, you know. And the thing is shown; it doesn't change. It's just it's obviously sun with a bit of retouching around it.
I was gonna say, when I post this program, I'm gonna use a photo. It's a 1957 photo of an alleged team of photographers capturing an atomic explosion in Nevada at a test site. And it's almost comical how fake this photo looks. There's this huge mushroom cloud-looking thing in the distance, and then a bunch of photographers, and it's very dramatic. And, I mean, it just looks totally phony. And I'm going to be taking the – all right, I got this photo from an article over in the New York Times entitled The Bomb Chroniclers. And it goes through and it talks about all these – cameramen who were connected to this film studio in Laurel Canyon, which is in the Hollywood Hills up in Los Angeles. And this film studio was funded by the United States Air Force. And it's where most of the video images of nuclear tests and a lot of this stuff coming from Japan, it's where all of this originated.
Yeah, that's right. That's Lookout Mountain. If you look on
Lookout Mountain,
if you look at nuclides.org, the ninth topic down there, you'll find the very first article there is on Lookout Mountain. That was, which has just been on sale. It was on sale a few years ago. I don't know who they sold it to. And we've got a whole lot of interesting stuff there, including other fake photos. For example, there's an iconic picture in London of St. Paul's Dome being blitzed, and that looks to me like a fake, very tempting thing to do. And of course, there's stuff on the moon as well. I'm just going down the list here. Slow-mo film explosions. That's quite an interesting point. Some of these things are slowed down. If you slow the sound down as well, you get the impression of a big cloud moving slowly, you know, rather than a sort of little, relatively close-up one.
Mm-hmm.
There are also these issues of, there's a quite well-known picture of both Groves and Oppenheimer in a desert. It's supposed to be where the towers vaporized. There's not, the sand isn't glassy, and it's like a remnant. It's just like a little it's a little incinerated, a little domestic thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a joke. I mean, I think some of these things are essentially jokes. There's an interesting one here as well about the so-called rainbow bomb, which produced no visible effect. They're supposed to have tested that for as electromagnetic pulses. Electromagnetic pulses are a thing which occasionally surface as a kind of aim or fear. And in fact, there weren't any. I think they tried to claim that in Hawaii there was a phone wouldn't work or something like that. But all of this stuff is quite interesting. There's the fake image. You must know about the fake moon stuff. I mean, there's loads of stuff about that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The fake nuke stuff is a relatively new thing, but that'll come soon. I mean, there's more of it, I think, than the nuclear stuff. There are enormous numbers of DVDs of these supposed nuke tests. And they had to do it, of course, to keep their cash flowing. They would invent new types of experiments to carry out and so on.
Yeah, you know, let me read part of this article from the New York Times, and I'm going to have a link to this when I post this program. It's really revealing, and it talks about how a lot of these videos were actually only declassified in 1997, and people were starting to write books about it and really explore it and post it online. And I think you can even buy a lot of these videos nowadays.
Yep.
And the article starts here. They risked their lives to capture on film hundreds of blinding flashes, rising fireballs, and mushroom clouds. The blast from one detonation hurled a man and his camera into a ditch. When he got up, a second wave knocked him down again. Then there was radiation. While many of the scientists who made atom bombs during the Cold War became famous, the men who filmed what happened when those bombs were detonated made up a secret team. Their existence and the nature of their work has emerged from the shadows only since the federal government began a concerted effort to declassify their films about a dozen years ago. In all, the atomic movie makers fashioned 6,500 secret films, according to federal officials. Today, the result is a surge in fiery images on television and movie screens, as well as growing public knowledge about the atomic filmmakers. The images are getting seared into people's imaginations, said Robert Norris, author of Racing for the Bomb and an atomic historian. They bear witness, he added, to extraordinary and terrifying power. Now, just think about that statement. These images are getting seared into people's imaginations. Yeah. This is the power of these images and how this idea was sold to the public.
It's just some guy trying to sell his rather low-quality book, isn't it? I mean, none of the stuff can be believed, in my view. Let me just go through this business of Jews in influential Jews at the time. Okay, I've got a list here of – these are just taken off the website. There's a chap called Spartz, S-P-A-A-T-Z. Sachs was another one. Oppenheimer. Szilard was another advisor, wasn't he? Einstein was a sort of background advisor. Rotblat was an interesting chap. He was part of the campaign for nuclear disarmament in Britain. I think he was sort of embedded, Jewish fake, really. Now, Eisenhower was also one, wasn't he? He was from Sweden, and he, offed quite a few million Germans under cover of Jewish censorship, in fact, because at the time the BBC was run by a chap called Jacobs, General Jacobs, I think, and that his rule ran after quite a long time after the Second World War. There's this chap, William L. Lawrence. His real name was Lipman. I can't pronounce it. Sue, S-I-E-U-W. It's Lithuanian. There's also Edward Teller, of course, who came along later. There's a chap here called Gunther Anders, who was part of the the moral movement against nukes, which, of course, was also a Jewish thing. I think Herbert Marcuse said something about it. There's a chap called Harry Dexter White. I'm not sure if he was Jewish or not. He was part of the thing.
I don't think he was Jewish, but he was a Soviet agent.
Ah, well, okay. The development of the atomic weapons was credited. This is by C.P. Snow, who was quite popular in Britain, although I don't think he had any idea about the Jewish issue. They attributed to four Hungarian, Czech, and Polish Jews. That was Leo Szilard, somebody called Eugene Wigner, Ulam, of course, Stanislav Ulam, and Edward Teller. Later on, of course, there was Samuel Cohen, who's made up or supposedly invented the neutron bomb. And who else as well? Bernard Baruch, of course, was a... nobody ever says how odd it is that you should have somebody who knows about money. What the hell are they supposed to know about nuclear stuff? Absolutely nothing. But anyway, Baruch was part of the Atomic Energy Commission. Mm-hmm. He was replaced by somebody from Kern Loeb and company called Lewis, according to my notes, Lewis Lichtenstein Strauss. And... well, of course, there was Oppenheimer, who got sacked for some reason. I've never been able to piece together. Now, there's also the atom spies. This was between 1944 and 1950. There were these supposed atom spies, Julius Rosenberg, Ethel Rosenberg, Martin Sobel, Harry Gold, Vid Greenglass, Klaus Emil, Julius Fuchs. They were all, communists, Jews. There's another interesting one. Was Bernard Brody. It's Bernard Brody and Hermann Kahn both wrote books on thermonuclear theory, which, again, it's bullshit. Hermann Kahn wrote On Thermonuclear War, and he got a reputation for being, very cold-hearted and evil and cruel because, of course, he's just playing with this stuff. He's, Megadeths. He's just making it all up. Mm-hmm. Another quite interesting example is Cyrus Eaton. He was a Canadian Jew who funded an organization called Pugwash, which operated only in Canada, I presume, so that he could overlook it. And that was part of the controlled opposition. You have people pretending to be anti these things. Well, of course, you could control it. You can have debates and disputes and stuff going on forever. Another interesting example is Randi, the magician, whose real name was Randall Schwinger, something like that. And he's got a forum called, which is run by Psionim operatives, as they're called, who investigate everything as long as it's not serious. It's not unlike Richard Dawkins, actually. Dawkins will not discuss serious topics. He's a bit lightweight in that sense. And in Britain, you've got these people. Lindemann was Churchill's advisor, and there was a Rothschild who got hold of all the British discoveries in radar. There's a chap called Zuckerman. There's Herman Bondi. Chap called R.E. Pearls, who supposedly did nuclear research. So these people are everywhere, And well, you know that, but it's important to kind of list them occasionally.
Yeah, no, sure. Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, they're they're everywhere. They're behind the alleged discovery and development of nuclear bombs, and they're leading the charge against them later on. They're involved in covering and photographing and filming these alleged bombs. I mean, it's like one big Jewish racket.
Yeah, incidentally, I think it's possible that part of the motivation for liberating these old films was actually, part of the plan may have been to get people like us talking about it. It may have been part of the exit strategy. They may have decided that people can be, freed of fear of nuclear weapons, and they issued these things, and they just hope people are going to identify them. So it is possible it's part of the policy. If they really wanted to keep belief in these things going, they'd probably not have released them. Okay, I think anyway.
You know, I wanted to ask you about other countries that allegedly have nuclear bombs, including Israel.
Including Israel, yeah, I think they're all fake. And as you pointed out to me, there's a piece there about Vanunu.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Mordecai. Yeah. I thought that was a really interesting perspective on he was the alleged whistleblower from Israel.
Yeah, that's right. He was a North African from, I forget which country, but there are Jews in North Africa with a lot of siblings. I think there must be a lot of them who look like him, which might be helpful. And he supposedly worked as a technician. There's some photos. They're on the website, actually. If you do, by the way, that website has got a search engine. If you want to look from biglies.org, there's a search. It's very fast. It's the stuff is already pre-searched, so it will return. If you look for Vanunu, you'll get the stuff about Vanunu. It's very good. I recommend it, actually. It's by free find. It's quite a good little search engine. Anyway, yeah, Vanunu. I went to some meetings in the late 90s. There was a kind of set of meetings at the Houses of Parliament, actually, about Vanunu. And they had a chap called Frank Barnaby, who I think must be part of the controlled opposition. And he'd got, there was a famous actress there. I think it was Julie Christie, famous actress, and all these people who were genuinely concerned. And of course, it's a lot of people were genuinely concerned. I mean, I went on an Alton Marston march myself in the early 60s, and Bertrand Russell was a campaigner against nukes, and he must have been quite embarrassing, really, because people who knew that it was a load of bullshit must have had to handle him with some care. He wrote various books on, you know, the common sense and nuclear warfare, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Accepting the full story. And, there you go. Let me just change the story here a bit to Japan. I've got a theory here which originated with Roger Desjardins, who is a Canadian who actually started this, I think. I could never get in touch with him. I had a couple of emails. I think I insulted him in some way, which was unintentional. But he seemed to be very good. Roger Desjardins, you can find him by looking on Nuclize, do a search. One of his claims was that clearing land by fire was a deliberate act to displace people who lived there before. It's possibly an analogy with the Great Fire of London. You know, after Cromwell had got Jews back into Britain, there was this Great Fire, like a couple of decades later, as a result of which the Bank of England was built. And it's quite possible that fire was started deliberately to clear land. And Curtis LeMay was actually given a high award. It's in December the 7th, 1974, it says here. He got the First Order of Merit with the Grand Cordon of the Rising Sun. This was to General Curtis LeMay, despite the fact that he's burnt, you know, a few million Japanese to death. And my theory is that there was a new elite. You see, Japan, a bit like, somewhat like Britain, got these islands off the mainland, and they had a nobility, you know, based on agriculture plus weaponry, I suppose. They had a samurai elite in Japan, and of course that seemed out of date, so it's quite possible that LeMay's land clearance scheme had the effect of introducing a new elite, you know, sort of money elite.
Mm-hmm.
Do you follow that?
So basically replacing the old elite with a new one that was handpicked by by the
they may have been handpicked, or they may have emerged naturally. There's something similar happened in the US earlier, I suppose, didn't it? In about 1900, there was an influx of Jews, and they managed to, unfortunately, managed to get through, get to the Federal Reserve in 1913, and they, in a way, displaced the previous elite. And that's a process still going on, and which one hopes will be reversed.
No doubt.
I hope it'll reversed anyway.
Yeah, it's pretty solidified at this point, unfortunately.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. And it sounds like it's the same over there in the United Kingdom as well.
Something similar happened. Yeah, the British elites, after Jews returned, particularly in the 19th century, there was a whole propaganda thing. For example, the Jews were known to have funded Napoleon against Britain, and there was a big move not to allow Jews free voting rights, that kind of thing, and access to the country. But the nonconformists, they had a sort of staged action to get them in, which I think Bertrand Russell's father or grandfather, wasn't it? Lord Russell took part in this, and he was awarded honours as a result of it. So yeah, it happened to Britain too. There are an awful lot of Jews mingled in with the old aristocracy. So there's, as I say, you've got these four. You had the four dwarfs, the four giants. I mean, four giant countries, three dwarfs. But there's also this axis going from Washington, London, and Moscow, with side shoots as well into, you know, Australia and South Africa as well, of course. Let me just summarize. I'll quote here from something I wrote when a chap said, oh, you can't possibly have a huge issue like this and hope to get it kept secret. This is what I wrote. This supposed bomb was shipped before supposedly being tested. The alleged test did not have the effects claimed. The bomb wasn't fitted with its aerials, which wouldn't have worked anyway. It couldn't have been aimed accurately. Accounts of the aiming are wrong. The crews were isolated and the planes not watched, and the accounts of the effects contradict each other. The supposed mushroom cloud is described in contradictory ways and was clearly an invention, and the film of it could not have been taken at the claimed time. Japanese witnesses didn't know it happened. Japanese accounts describe fire and nothing like this supposed effect of a huge high-temperature blast. Aerial photography of the after effects were indistinguishable from bombing raids of the time, with no central blast zone. The film crew specifically sent to record the event didn't do so. The Indianapolis, which carried a supposed bomb, was sunk on the voyage back to the USA and was left 4 days without any assistance. The Japanese weren't told the events were nuclear until long after, when they had to be told by propaganda films. Trams were running 3 days later. The claims about shadows of bodies are wrong. There were no radiation effects. There are no seismic indicators that the supposed events took place, and the story to this day is still not consistent. And I went on to talk about the Holocaust, Armenian genocide, genocide in Ukraine, Vietnam, the Kennedy murder, all examples of cover-ups, and so on. So
that's a very good summary of, you know, what really happened in Japan and what really didn't happen in Japan.
Okay, there are just a few points there that I realize I haven't mentioned. For example, the bomb aiming. If you look at accounts of bomb aiming at that time, there's a radius or an ellipse, you know, in the direction the thing is flying, and they couldn't even have been sure of getting it within Hiroshima. You know, you're asked to believe in a bomb that's cost millions, billions, whatever it is, of dollars, and with the technology of the time, they couldn't even be sure of dropping it in the right place. That is true. The Indianapolis is another interesting example. There are, I think, still some Indianapolis survivors. Do you know the story of that?
No, actually. Could you just give us a brief summary?
All right. Let me look through my my thing here. The Indianapolis left San Francisco. It left San Francisco just after. Let me just find it here.
No, it's okay.
I can't find it. Here we are. Yeah. Okay. July the 16th, Indianapolis. July 16th, 1945. It left just after dawn. It left San Francisco, obviously, to cross the Pacific, aimed for Tinian, and it unloaded supposed two nukes. Now, what happened, what the people thought of it, is of course, not really known, not known to me anyway. And the ship was sent back across the Pacific on the 30th 2 weeks later, it was sank by some Japanese people, and it was deliberately ignored. There were reports, a Japanese telegram, or whatever it's called, was deciphered, and in case they knew that it had sunk. And there's a whole website on it, actually. The only reason the sailors were saved after about 4 days in the shark-infested water was because some plane happened to fly across it, and they couldn't apparently sort of disown what this pilot said. So, and I'm sure that was deliberate. It was deliberate. It was sent back without any escort, and it's known how to provoke these things. There's been a history of the U.S. provoking submarine attacks. So the Indianapolis was, in my view, almost certainly because people on board had information about the nukes, supposed nukes on board. That was Little Boy and mm-hmm. Fat Man. Mm. Okay, so that's Indianapolis. Okay, what else was there? The Indianapolis was sunk, that's right. Yeah, that's a fair summary, I think.
I think that summary you read was very well stated. So I guess, do you think, how has this hoax been perpetuated and maintained? I mean, is it really a result of the media and some of these manufactured videos that come out of this Laurel Canyon film studio? Is that really what's driving this and perpetuating this hoax, in your view?
I think, it's all sorts of things, isn't it? It's visual media, it's printed media, mm-hmm. and it's also a lot of military people go along with it. Whether they believe in it, I just have no idea. It's impossible to say. Presumably, most of them do. And, they regard it not being their fault. It's somebody else's department, wouldn't they? That's what it would be.
Interesting. I don't know, has there been anybody that's been connected to the military or connected to this industry that's come out and kind of raised questions about it, to your knowledge?
No, not that I know of. I think it's too much of a hot potato, but I expect that will start to happen mm-hmm. as a result of people like us talking about it. And I think they'll piece together the whole business here, what's going on here, because there was a Potsdam Declaration. The terms of surrender for Japan were announced in mid-1945, July the 26th, 1945. And it wasn't necessary. The Japanese were known to have been desperate to surrender. So it was the war, in other words, was deliberately prolonged to shoehorn in this nuke thing. It may have been also another interesting possibility that it was to do with the Vietnam War. I mean, the Americans did bomb Vietnam for about 30 years afterwards, mm-hmm. 1945. And there was there must have been connections there, I think, anyway. And of course, Japan was involved. Japan had invaded Vietnam in the 40s sometime, I think it was, displacing the French, incidentally. So the French had an animus against the Vietnamese and the Japanese. But that went on until 1954. There was a battle called Dien Bien Phu, where the French were completely defeated. And after that, unfortunately, the Americans took over. And that may have been just to make money, because part of the Jewish ideology, which a lot of people don't understand, is that, killing off non-Jews is a laudable aim, if you can do it, particularly if you can do it without getting caught. So they've got no objection to funding both sides of a war. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the Vietnam War, the Jews controlled the money supply, and they could buy out industries, so they must have had fingers in the pies of things like bomb manufacture and helicopter manufacture and ship manufacture and building ports and that kind of stuff. Huge industry of these kind of destructive, useless things. And from their point of view, if Americans get killed off, that's great. There's some, got rid of a few whites. If gooks get killed off, they couldn't care less, because it's, they're inferior people to them. Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of the dynamic, which is often ignored, because most people in the Christian tradition just don't have that kind of attitude. It's out of there. If you see bombs falling, you think, well, that's destructive. You don't think, oh, that's, $10,000 for each bomb dropped. Yippee, rub your hands together.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what many Christian peoples did to Germany during World War II. You know, I wanted to ask you, what is your general take from a sort of revisionist British perspective? What is your general take on World War II?
Well, I think it was pretty, basically, I think I've got a review of Mein Kampf, which I wrote about a year ago on my website, and I think basically Hitler showed very convincingly that if you get rid of Jewish sort of parasites, you can do very well. It was a tiny little country, and look at the defense it put up. It had four other major industrial powers against it, and also people like India and China, and yet they were, horrendous to defeat, and they nearly got into the USSR. They might have captured the USSR. So I think, anyway, Hitler proved that you could do well with your own money system, and I think that lesson still is sort of echoes. I think if you look at this BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, it's possible, I'm not saying it's true, but it's possible that they're fed up with US paper money, being paid worthless paper for their goodies, and that they're going to set up an alternative money system, different from what happened in 1945. And one of their supporting bits of evidence must, I think, be that Hitler's independence, when he had barter and money issued in, roughly speaking, correspondingly to what was needed. So that's, I think he was, and that's why the Jews hated him. I mean,
Exactly.
there was this policy for ever since about the 1934, when they declared war on Germany, and they were very unscrupulous, nothing, lies, deceits, assassinations. They just, it seems, I think it's instinctive. I do have a theory that after, well, I accept the Khazar theory, that the Jews were sort of invented by conversion in Khazaria in about 800 AD, or maybe it was 700 AD, right? I mean, it's a pity if they'd have chosen Christianity instead, they would have had a belt going across the world there. Anyway, so they converted, and I think, you see, if you take Judaism seriously, they were an illiterate, I presume they were illiterate before that, and all of a sudden they've got this volume, and it's their sole reading. Just as in the Middle Ages, a lot of people only read the Bible, all they read was Talmudic stuff, which is extremely nasty stuff, and it would, if people said, "Oh, this is rubbish," they would kill them. It's part of their system of ethics, was that you can kill people who don't like it. And I think you'd end up, after a few generations, you'd end up with people who are fanatical and unable to, to be kind of honest, to be normal people. It's
Right.
just, I suspect that's the case anyway.
Yeah, and I think Hitler recognized the Jews correctly as a separate alien race that was living in Europe, and they're
Yes.
very subversive. Do you go along with that?
Yeah, I mean, a sub-race. I don't know that enough is known about DNA and stuff to be sure if of the origin of all the various races. I mean, I accept it's possible. Some people say that blacks are Cro-Magnon is the correct pronunciation, I think. I don't know, but certainly Jews appear to be a sub-race, which is bred especially in a kind of fanatical way. In the same way, you see, if you look at China, that had Confucianism imported to it, which is a very kind of polite system in which you've got elaborate rules and you're trying to be nice to each other, and that did seem to work very well. I mean, China ended up as a, after numerous wars, it did at least seem to end up as a unified thing, which is more than any other country did. So I do think that the printed word and oratory and ideas do have a genetic effect on people eventually. I mean, Chinese are noticeably different from African. I think I accept much of what Kevin McDonald implies about blacks being, they lived in a country which was relatively easy to live in, but was also dangerous. I mean, you could get eaten by leopards at any time, or whatever, or stung, bitten by the world's most poisonous snakes. But on the other hand, there was food. The temperature was right, so you've got no real motive for planning ahead.
Right.
So I accept all that kind of stuff, really. But what to do about it is a difficult issue, because whites do tend to be scatty and, easily bribable, don't they? And they'll do what they're told. You get these people bombing perfectly innocent civilians, and they just you know, it's no skin off their nose sort of thing. Anyway.
Well, we seem to be very exploitable through propaganda.
Yeah.
And imagery. I mean, this goes all the way back to, I mean, the subject we're talking about today, nuclear bombs. And the Holocaust. The Holocaust largely is a essentially a psychological operation targeting our emotions. I don't know if you'd go along with that, or you know, I mean, think about all the horrific images that we've been shown over and over and over to quote unquote prove that this Holocaust happened.
Yeah. So I think that's right. If you're in a way, Jews show the advantage of fanaticism. You know, in the 19th century, there was a general belief that if people are fanatic, they'd sort of cut their own throats and provoke reactions. But it's so much simpler with Jews. You know, if you've got you want to decide whether you want to promote the Holocaust, you know, you should say to them, well, you know, you can make a lot of money out of the Goyim. And that's to say, right, we'll make a lot of money, we'll do that. And if there's some big fraud, you know, like 9/11, all the Jews involved must have had minimal reservations about it. The only worry they'd have was if they got caught. And it is very difficult, and they must have had collaborators who were just normal people and who must have been bought out. And it's the same policy, same sort of principle as NASA. I mean, I don't know what these – I don't know if they're still around. Is Buzz Aldrin still going around? I don't know. But Armstrong.
You know, I'm not sure, actually. He's probably pretty old at this point if he still is.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're in some sort of agreement. It's what you'd expect if there's some external forces which act on you for a long time. You're going to end up affected by them, aren't you? It's not unreasonable. It's not an unreasonable supposition. Now, let's see here. What else is there about nukes? Oh, I just remembered Jonathan Pollard, who's another spy.
Right.
There's so many of these people. I've got some examples here. This is stuff after 45. There was an International Military Tribunal, which was not considered important, presumably because Jews wouldn't get any money out of it. There's Deir Yassin, the massacre in 1948. That's when you know, Israel was founded.
Uh-huh.
Then there's 1949. James Forrestal was murdered, probably as a result of being opposed to Jews. And this is where things like civil defense films started up, you know, the duck and cover, that kind of stuff. Let's Face It, that's a good example. That's got stuff in it which includes a mock-up of Hiroshima, I think, actually. If you look at it, you can see clips of what was subsequently included in a film supposedly about Hiroshima.
Mm-hmm.
Then 67, you've got the USS Liberty, was attacked by Israel. And 67, Lewin, Report from Iron Mountain. It's a kind of book essentially on Jewish power controlling things and turning spigots using money control. It's quite interesting. And then you've got this stuff with people like Golda Meir and Kissinger, Nixon, and stuff about the Islamic bomb and so on. By the way, you mentioned earlier other bombs, and we had a look at some of these. There's ones in the French ones and the Indian ones, and the Pakistani ones always look like nonsense. If you look at on nuclearized.org, number 9, there's ridiculous, well, US Army simulation device. There's a supposed 1967 YouTube test. There's 1957 fraud. There's also stuff about Pakistan, and they are very unconvincing. They just look like dynamite or something put underground.
Yeah, I've seen some of them, and they're, you know, when you go back and take a second look at a lot of these, it's very, very fishy, to say the least. It's almost laughable, some of them. Do you think a lot of these were coordinated by the West and released and perhaps faked in some way?
Good question. I think there are lots of scientific frauds, for example, to do with cell biology and other frauds, like the Shakespeare authorship thing, for example. And they tend to be international. I think it's because you get a clique of scholars, or scholars in quotes, and they all tend to exchange information with each other. So I'm sure that the thing is basically Jewish, you know, but I'm sure you'll have all these Pakistani and Indian physicists, and of course they get a lot of money out of it. But by comparison with your average Pakistani or Indian, they're living in, you know, palatial luxury. They've got absolutely no reason to deny any of this stuff, and they use the same vocabulary, and they are very derivative. You know, it's rather sad. You expect them to be, in principle, there might be a new rush of blood from, you know, fresh inlet of blood from these places, but in practice they stick with what they've got. They know which side butters their bread, you know. So
yeah, it's interesting because a lot of these hoaxes, well, for instance, the whole A-bomb hoax, they are international in scope, and there's multiple countries involved in this. So how do they coordinate everybody to kind of go along with it?
Yeah, well, there must be exceptions. I think after 45, Britain was cut out of contact with the USA, despite the fact that they'd collaborated throughout it. So was Canada as well, I think. And I think the reason for that was probably because Jews were not happy enough about the control in Britain. They thought some British people might, I mean, C.P. Snow was an example, some of these British people were not under the thumbs of Jews. And so my reading of it is that if there's a threat, then they won't, you know, they'll cut off from groups. And that might have happened in other countries. I mean, there's only, I don't know if Brazil, for example, ever intended to get an atom bomb. But if they did, there's friction with the U.S., isn't there, I presume.
Mm-hmm.
And probably there might well be friction with U.S. Jews. I don't know the situation in Brazil, but I'd be surprised if that didn't happen. So it's quite possible that the reason Brazil doesn't have a nominal atom bomb is because of that. And conversely, looking at the other way around, China claimed to have an H-bomb. If you watch their videos, they're exceedingly, you know, implausible. But now, does that mean that Jews were controlled just like the technology in China? Or does it mean that there was Jewish money there? And I don't know. I have seen, I mean, there were Jews in China, probably supporting Mao, but the full details there are not known to me. I don't think you need somebody like a Chinese version of David Irving to go through their records, really. I'm sorry to be so vague, because honestly, I just don't know. But there are, you know, you can see the situation. There are some things where they get along together. Say, nuclear power is another good example. In my view, this is a bit off the topic of Hiroshima, except in the sense that it's a linear descendant of it. But in my view, nuclear power has been fairly well established to be dump loads. And I think it's accepted. I've seen a video of Chinese people signing a contract for, quotes, nuclear power stations, unquote. And in fact, they seem to be just building dump loads. They call dump loads nuclear power stations.
Now, what exactly do you mean by dump loads?
Oh, this is part of, it's not really relevant to this issue, but it's a very important part of nuclear power. I've got a long explanation. Again, if you look at nuclides, you'll find there's a forum on, specifically on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just find it here. It's number nuclear power doubts. There it is. It's, you go to nuclize.org.
Okay.
And it's 5, 6, it's the seventh one down. Nuclear power doubts, nuclear disasters, safe power, is nuclear power a hoax? And there's an introduction there which mentions the idea, there are two possible views, well, there's three. If you think that they generate electricity, that's one view. But they could be a toxic dump store because some of these things are underground and nobody can investigate them because they think they're radioactive. The other theory is a dump load. The idea there is, it's very simple once it's pointed out. If you've got power stations generating electricity, the load varies all the time. You know, people turn things on and off, factories or whatever. And so in order to deal with that, you have to have enough electricity to keep them working. And there's no, you can't just fire up a power station in, you know, a fraction of a second. You have to have an allowance for that. You have to be able to control it. And the dump load is just, it's like a giant, huge electric kettle, really. It just sits there steaming away. When the load is suddenly goes up, you turn down the load to the dump load, and it's, so that starts cooling, but the other stuff, because I'm sorry, this is a terrible explanation. Let me give you another example, which I usually give, which is very easy to understand. Suppose there's a ball game, right? And halfway through, 5 million people turn on their coffee making equipment, right? Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh,
I'm here.
Sorry. Yeah, all right, no sorry. Problem. I thought it suddenly went very quiet. It's a 5 million people, and they've got, say, a one megawatt, not 1 megawatt, a kilowatt, kettle or something. You've suddenly got 5 gigawatts just needed within a very short time. So what they do is they have a permanent situation where there's too much electricity, and it goes into these dump loads, and they sit there steaming away. When you see these cooling towers steaming away, that's what's happening. The power is being dumped. It's not a sort of byproduct of nuclear power.
So it's just a way to store excess electricity?
Yeah, well, it doesn't store it. It just gets rid of it. There's no really easy way of storing it. The cheapest way is just to get rid of it. I think if the water runs out, they'll melt down. You'll get the equivalent of tens of thousands or hundreds of millions of electric fires all going at once. Anyway, that's the dump load hypothesis. And I saw recently that Britain has signed a deal with China for nuclear power stations. I presume what that means is that these cooling towers have run out of useful life, and so they're going to get some cheap ones replacing them. And they pretend it's nuclear power. It's part of the system there. If you look at the chapter here, this is part 7 of nuclearized.org, you've got a whole lot of things here on India nuclear power, including arguments against it. You see, there's a shortage of uranium now. They're supposed to be building these things with a uranium shortage. And we've got other stuff here about nuclear power in Turkey. Mm-hmm. Nuclear submarines is quite an important thing. We don't believe that there are nuclear submarines. They're probably electrical or something, or just the same sort of technology they used to use, something like that, because A, it would be dangerous, and B, we can't see any evidence for it. There's another good argument against nuclear power, which is that it does not exist in places where you might expect it, like Antarctica or the Arctic. You've got these cold areas. Just a simple unit which sits there making your electricity would make perfect sense. In fact, they have damn great storage towers with oil in. The same with Hawaii. This is another point made by first-class skeptic. In Hawaii, they transport coal, oil, what have you there. Why not have a perfectly adapted nuclear power station? So that nuclear power does also seem to be fake. And in fact, it would be very easy to test it, get a competent electrical engineer. In fact, I just wonder if Arthur Butz might be able to do that. If you remember, Arthur Butz was he wrote the hoax of the 20th century, I think it was called.
Yep.
About the Holocaust, and he is by profession an electrical engineer, and a lecturer. I mean, he knows about it, so he'd be a very good person to investigate whether nuclear power is a hoax or not. But as far as I know, I tried to email him, but I couldn't get through. Didn't get through.
This is a little bit off topic from Nagasaki and Hiroshima, but I wanted to ask you what do you make of all these nuclear disasters that have allegedly taken place over time,
yeah. Like
Chernobyl, the latest Fukushima alleged disaster. I'm not sure exactly what to make of all these situations.
Oh, I think they're just engineered. I don't believe there's anything serious there at all. It's my personal belief.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kind of ignore them really now. I've got to the stage where I just take it as being a fake. I'm trying to find something here a bit more relevant to. Have you got a halfway tune or something you play? I'll just go through my stuff in my notes here.
Well, we only have about 30 minutes left of the program.
All right, okay.
So I don't know. I mean, we can wrap up early if we need to. I don't know if there's any other
questions. No, it's okay. Ask me, have you got any more questions that I can answer?
Yeah, I guess I'm curious what you make of all these alleged disasters. You just think that they're just essentially media hyped events? I mean, there's nothing really going on there, nothing to worry about.
Oh, I think they'd make money out of it, wouldn't they? I don't think they'd just plan it like that. There'd be, it cost $5 billion or something to correct the thing. There's some interesting stuff in Canada about a nuclear power, so-called nuclear power station there, which is going to cost something $10 billion or something to repair.
Mm-hmm.
They've got over themselves, really. They take it for granted now that they can make up stories and get any amount of money out of it. Whether that will continue, I don't know. There's another point here, actually, about Pearl Harbor. If you remember, there are two Let's discuss the justice of the Japanese war case, which is kind of relevant to Hiroshima. And there are two incidents. There was the so-called rape of Nanking, and there was the Pearl Harbor thing. And yeah, there are big question marks over both of these events. The Nanking, it was promoted by Japan involved in it. So,
and you're talking about the massacre?
Yeah, well, it was the alleged massacre, yeah.
Okay.
That's there's a question mark over whether that's what actually happened, you know. And
sure.
Similarly with Pearl Harbor, I mean, you must know that it's it was known beforehand. They drafted the speech, you know, the something about the annals of infamy, and that was drafted beforehand. But all these kind of gullible Americans thought, oh, we've been attacked, we must go back to war.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, once you promote a thing, as I was saying earlier, they had an attack back. The Americans immediately attacked back, not very successfully, in fact, but just to get them in the war and make the Japanese fight back. It's kind of analogous to the Polish events in Germany, as far as I understand it, although there's a lot of debate about this now. The Second World War was supposedly started by Germany invaded Poland, but Poland, the story goes, provoked Germany, you know, intolerably with all kinds of actions on the border.
Mm-hmm.
But this is another thing. That's the next thing that's going to get blown up, I think, really, because, you know, attention will be concentrated on it because it's such an important part of the war. If you cast doubts on the reasons for starting the war, then that's another part of the thing that unbuckles, isn't it? Now, anyway, as to Japan and the war, I just have no idea. I mean, Japan certainly, well, there's no question it invaded Manchuria and Vietnam as well. It had because of the sea coast thing. Well, and Korea also was invaded by Japan at some point. I don't know if that was anything to do with the Korean War, but the justice or otherwise of the Japanese case really would be gone into. There's a Japanese chap on called something like Anti-Kike, who's supposed to have the fifth biggest website in Japan. I was told, I mean, if that's true. But there are Japanese Americans who might look into that. I hope so, because I like truth.
So are they basically saying that a lot of these atrocities allegedly committed by Japan were just, you know, it's just more war propaganda by the Allies?
I think so. I don't
to
know
demonize the Japanese?
I think a lot of Japanese would agree with that, yeah.
Yeah.
I have
heard that, you know, a lot of the atrocities allegedly committed by the Japanese were just – it was basically what they were doing to the Germans. They were making up all these atrocity stories and saying the Germans were committing all these murders and committing all these war crimes when in reality they weren't at all. It was the Allies that were doing all of that and just blaming it on Germany.
It's entirely possible. It certainly worked with Germany. And, of course, you get these people who were – prisoners of the Japanese, and I don't think they don't seem to understand what the situation was. You know, these Japanese would have a sort of telegram from home saying that their town had been burnt to the ground, and you know they were all homeless or something like that. And you get these kind of arrogant white people who had no business in Asia anyway, sort of telling them they wanted a you know decent cup of tea or something. I'm not. It doesn't kind of surprise me that they their tempers were frayed. You know, but. Who knows? I mean, but I do think that's relevant to it. I mean, it should be the justice or otherwise of their case is something worth looking at, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Ray, I don't know if you had any concluding remarks to make about this subject. I think it's very important that we do take a second look at what we were told about nuclear technology and nuclear weapons. And question whether or not this is, you know, another hoax designed to scare us and to fund this massive industry.
Okay. There's obviously an indefinite amount I could say, but I think maybe it makes sense to stop now because then it's less forbidding for people to listen to as well.
Mm-hmm.
My 3.5-hour video was a bit of a shock to me. It's too long, really. So the only concluding remark I have is that I'm fairly convinced that this was a fake and the other nuke stuff, and also fairly convinced that it was largely a Jewish thing. So that's what we have to do something about. And this has been this this attitude has existed since about, as far as I know, 2005. Roger Desjardins was the first person to do it. I've only been involved since about 2008,
mm-hmm.
and I just hope more people get involved. I noticed that some of the Kodo chap is going to get involved, I think, if he's forgotten his name.
Are you Bradley Smith?
Bradley Smith, yes, he's mentioned nukes a few times. It must be because of this kind of stuff, I'm sure.
Huh, interesting.
He'd be good. Well, something like Kodo's campaign for open debate on Hiroshima. He could open a cartoon, couldn't he? Yeah, I mean, it's very nice to speak to you, and should we cut it off there? Am I fairly convincing? I hope so.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I really haven't delved too much into this topic until, you know, the past week or so when I was kind of preparing for this. And I'm pretty convinced. I mean, there's all sorts of questions about it, and I find it very suspicious, a lot of the, just all the Jewish connections to it. And the fact that, I mean, just read the, when I post this program, you guys are going to see a link to that New York Times article where it's talking about this one film studio in Hollywood, which was responsible for making all of these videos depicting, nuclear bombs being exploded. It's just very fishy. I find it very, very fishy. And if you look at the agenda, how it's been used to keep us in fear, I think it does actually make a lot of sense that this very well could indeed be just another hoax designed to keep us in fear and advance their agenda. So,
anyway, that's Lookout Mountain. Of course, it does affect the whole situation with Israel as well. If they don't have nuclear defense, they're a lot more naked than they like to make out.
That's true.
Bear that in mind, and that might in fact become very important if there's some substantial movement against Israel, against Jews, which I think they deserve. And that'll be part of the package. Anyway, as I say, it's very nice to speak to you. And nuclize.org, have a look. And also video, Google for Lords of the Nukes. Very long, same length as if you'd stand Lord of the Rings, you can stand Lord of the Nukes. Okay.
Okay, thanks, Ray. Appreciate it.
Yep. Well, thanks to you as well.